I would now like to hand the conference back over to you, Dave.
Okay. Thank you, Melanie. I appreciate that. So our first presenter today to provide some opening remarks is Ms. Amy Geis. Amy is the chief of the planning division here in the Baltimore District for the Army Corps of Engineers. She's been tagged to oversee the completion of the comp study, but before becoming a supervising project manager, Amy served as an ecologist for the Corps. So with that, I'll pass it over to Amy for her to give an overview of the comp study. Amy?
Good morning. I have three slides just to give an overview. We have provided more detailed information in the past, but we know that others are following these webinars, so we wanted to use our time wisely. We do have a website available where there is an executive level overview and a little bit more detail and other information about the comp study, as well as a subscribe list where you can receive updates. But for today's webinar, I will have my opening remarks in the next three slides. Hurricane Sandy impacted, as you know, the Atlantic coastline in October 2012, and that area was then covered in the Sandy Supplemental Appropriations Bill, and that was passed by Congress, and it was directed the Corps and many other federal agencies to some follow-up actions, and one of those actions for the Corps was in to do a comprehensive study up to $20 million addressing those areas that were impacted, including the areas of greatest impact, New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. Next slide, please. This shows the study area as it has been defined for the comp study. All of the area that is colored is part of the study area for the comprehensive study. This was determined by the FEMA impact zones. They do have the variation of color, but that is just pointing out the level of severe impacts, again, in that New Jersey, New York area. But the entire colored area is covered in the comprehensive study. The comprehensive study directed by Congress is to look at flood risks of vulnerable coastal populations, and it is to be completed and submitted to Congress by January 2015. We will be looking at coastal resilient communities and sustainable coastal landscapes, future sea level rise, climate change scenarios, looking at ways to reduce risk to vulnerable populations, property, ecosystems, infrastructure. And, of course, this leads us into further discussions about nature-based infrastructure and ecosystem goods and services, which is the topic of today's briefing. Next slide. As part of the comprehensive study, we have an extensive Corps of Engineers team as well as subject matter experts from many other agencies participating with us in the formulation and analyses that will be part of the study. Coming out of the study, the best way to describe it to me is that this will be a roadmap or a framework on a state-by-state basis that will identify those areas of risk and those vulnerable coastal populations and those measures that can be considered for future study, implementation, or whatnot. It will go from local land use suggestions the whole way to structural and non-structural and policy and programmatic measures. We will also be identifying, as directed by Congress, any institutional barriers to comprehensive implementation. This is not what we consider or call a decision document. There will not be projects for authorization and implementation. This is a study authority that Congress provided to us, not a construction authority, and it will not include NEPA documentation. For any areas that are identified for future study or analysis, that's where the more site-specific planning, design, environmental documentation, impacts would be considered. But at this regional scale, that detail is not part of this particular study. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Amy. Let's get right into our presentation today, focusing again, as Amy mentioned, on the natural and nature-based infrastructure, specifically ecosystem goods and services that that those features can offer. So with that, with our first discussion, we'd like to focus on the framework by identifying and assessing ecosystem goods and services. And with that, Ms. Elizabeth Murray is here today to talk about that and provide a briefing. Elizabeth has worked as a wetland scientist over 20 years, specializing in wetland assessment ecological restoration, and resource management. She works in the wetlands and coastal ecology branch of the environmental lab at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Engineering Research and Development Center. Although she has worked primarily as an ecologist, Elizabeth's master's degree incorporates environmental economics as well as ecology, and she often works on multidisciplinary projects. She is working in the Corps' national effort to investigate the potential for incorporating ecosystem goods and services in civil works and restoration planning, and has reports on the topic. So with that, Elizabeth, if you could go ahead and begin your presentation.
Sorry, okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for that introduction. Again, you're going to be hearing from three of us today, and all of the presentations are related. And so overarching topic is going to be ecosystem goods and services relating to natural and nature-based infrastructure. But each of those subtopics is a little bit different. Next slide, please. So first you're going to be hearing from me. I'm a co-PI on a national effort at the Corps to look into incorporating ecosystem goods and services into our planning process. And our team has recently published a tech report and TechNote reviewing EGS literature and presenting a framework or conceptual model for conducting EGS assessment within the Corps, and that's going to be followed up by our third speaker today. I'll be presenting an introduction of ecosystem goods and services sort of based on those publications, the review of the literature. Then we're going to be hearing from Kelly Brooks-Copes, who's the team lead developing strategies to identify and measure benefits specifically for natural and nature-based infrastructure in concert with structural features to address coastal resiliency at the systems level. And she'll show you their work and consensus-level approaches, as well as specific considerations for formulating potential projects. And then finally, you're going to hear from Dr. Lisa Langer, an environmental economist, working with both the planning framework effort as well as the Sandy effort, and she will be getting into the weeds and showing you some case studies. So with that overview of the webinar, I'll go ahead and start out with my introduction. Next slide, please. So my team has been working for the last several years on reviewing ecosystem goods and services, the state of the science, the state of policy, the state of tools that are in development by various entities out there in the world, and trying to get a handle on whether or not these tools are ready to be implemented and whether or not the Corps can operationalize the approach on our planning projects. And as you can see from this, we've got a lot of people involved at the Corps and some also in academia. Next slide. The ecosystems goods and services, the approach, is really an interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary approach merging both ecological and economic principles. And historically, both of those fields, ecology and economics, sort of independently determined that it was really necessary to try to get an understanding of the social goods and economic goods that ecosystems provided to society. And as a result of that, out of ecology came the field of ecological economics, and out of the economic field came the study or the field of environmental economics. And back when all of this was just sort of starting in the early 70s, you can imagine that ecological economics was very, very good at the ecology side of things, and that the environmental economics was very good at the economic side of things and sort of oversimplified the ecology. But over the last 40 years or so, they've really come together. And so now what is called the field of, say, environmental economics actually does a fairly decent job of covering the complexities of the ecological system as well. The reason that it's important to note this, though, is that if you look at the literature out there, you know, in peer-reviewed journals and such, there's a wide variation of terms, of approaches. They have, as time has moved on, converged, but the earlier literature especially can be quite confusing because a lot of the terminology, each of those fields of economics and ecology can use the same words to mean quite different things. And so it's very important as we move forward and as we think about ecosystem goods and services to actually define our terms as we move along, because there are as many definitions of ecosystem goods and services as there are papers about it, pretty much. Next slide. So the working definition that has been used by our team and proposed for planning is as follows. Ecosystem goods and services are socially valued aspects or outputs of ecosystems that depend on self-regulating or managed ecosystem structures and processes. And the things to note about this definition is that we're recognizing that although natural ecosystems provide these services, many of our ecosystems that we have now are managed, and they're often managed for a particular use, but they provide services beyond that use for which they are managed. So, for instance, the Mississippi River is managed for navigation, but it's providing many, many, many other services as well. Next slide. So there are numerous ways to classify ecosystem goods and services, but one of the more useful ways to look at them, if you're going to try to actually do any sort of monetization, is to divide them into use and non-use services, because the way that you address getting dollar amounts for those is different. Total economic value of an ecosystem, say, is the combination of the use and non-use values. So can you click forward, please? No, sorry. There should have been a go back. There should have been an animation. Can you click the space bar? Thank you. Okay, so for direct use, for instance, examples of that would be fishing and drinking water. Indirect use would be things more like flood risk management. So direct use, think you have to go to some place and actually extract something from the area. Indirect use, you're using something from the ecosystem, but you're not actually going there and taking it. Option is the potential future use. So we want to have that flood risk mitigation in the future, or we want to have genetic resources in the future. Non-use values are things more akin to existence and bequest. I just like knowing that that the Everglades are there, and I want in the example of bequest to know that my children can also go to the Everglades at some point if they want to. Hit the space bar, please. Anyway, as we move from left to right here, from direct use to bequest, these services are more and more difficult to actually monetize. Okay, next slide. Another way to think about ecosystem goods and services are final versus intermediate goods and services. I'll be showing you a framework or a conceptual model in a few slides from now where you can see that there's this flow of process from ecosystem structure or function through intermediate goods and services and into final goods and services. Ecosystem structure and function are the things that scientists like myself and others, I'm sure, in the room are very comfortable measuring and accounting for. Things like sedimentation rates, water depth, biodiversity. They're very quantifiable. They're often academic. They exist in the ecosystem independent of demand. Whether or not humans are nearby and care about these things, nature's just doing this. Intermediate goods and services tend to be very intuitive. Things like quality of water, water supply capacity, species preservation. They're usually components of final services, and they can relate to potential for demand, but there's usually not express demand incorporated into the metrics for those. When you get to final goods and services, you're talking about things that are very recognizable to the public, so drinking water supply, flood risk management, commercial fisheries, things that contribute directly to society and sometimes have a market associated with them. The relationship of those final goods and services to humans has a definite economic component in terms of supply and demand and scarcity and those types of things. And so they're often quantifiable, often recognizable, but not always easily monetized. When you're trying to operationalize a system whereby you're going to be measuring goods and services of a project, it's important to note that if you're combining intermediate goods and services with final goods and services, oftentimes you end up double counting because the intermediate services feed into the final services. And so economists particularly get very upset by that. So many economists prefer to only deal with final goods and services, although if there's not enough information to deal with those strictly, intermediate goods and services can sometimes be used as proxies for them, but you don't want to combine them in the same analysis. Next slide. Now, in any ecosystem or management activity, you can have joint production or trade-offs of services. A given site might produce multiple services, and if those services are complementary, for instance, waterfowl habitat and flood protection, they can be simultaneously maximized at a site by considering joint production. On the other hand, competing services cannot be simultaneously maximized, because one interferes with the other. And they require making trade-offs among services, and that's a different type of decision tool needed. So, for instance, there was a case in New Jersey. New Jersey Supreme Court ruling on borough of Harvey Cedars and Cran, where property owners had sued the city because the city had restored some coastal dunes and disrupted their ocean views, and lower courts had awarded the homeowners like $370,000 each for the loss of the view, but then after Hurricane Sandy happened and they realized that those dunes had provided a lot of flood protection, the higher courts had struck that down, saying that although they had lost the view, they had gained a different service because of those dunes. Next slide. So my team has gone through an exercise where we've identified ecosystem service categories that core projects often influence. And here you can just see some examples of what those ecosystem service categories are and the types of influences that our projects typically have on them. This is something that as recommendations coming out of this comprehensive plan get implemented might become something that ends up getting looked at as part of the planning process. Next slide. So, I apologize if that got covered up. Essentially, what we need to be looking at, and when we're thinking about ecosystem goods and services, is linking ecosystems to human welfare. And so we need to be thinking in terms of conceptual models that link changes in the ecosystem resulting from restoration activities or nature-based infrastructure or any other type of project, really, that is affecting an ecosystem and the impact of those projects on the ecosystem services that benefit humans. And so looking at this graphic from Palmer and Filoso, you can see that in the bottom there's a restoration. This is an example from restoration, but there's a restoration toolbox and a bunch of things that we as an agency or other partners might do to an ecosystem. And that has an effect on the ecosystem. So we try to restore something and we try to remove exotics or whatever we're going to do, and that has a complex series of impacts on the ecosystem and ecosystem functions. And then that, in turn, has an impact on ecosystem services. So let's take a little closer look at these interactions. Next slide. This is a conceptual model or a framework for developing an EGS assessment, and it's very, very solidly based in the literature. There's lots of different examples that will look pretty similar to this in the literature. This is just sort of a simplified version where we've defined our terms. So box one is that there is a management activity which leads to ecological outcomes via a response function. So that response function estimates the expected changes and ecological outcomes. These are biophysical outcomes when conditions and stressors change. So if we have a change in flow regime, how might that affect fish movement? How would restore a wetland slow floodwaters? And that's going to be measured in terms of like a velocity or something along those lines. There's going to be oftentimes significant data gaps identified and addressed, but this is all going from box one to box two via the response function. This is all just, science. Next slide. When you go then from ecological outcomes to ecosystem goods and services, you do that via an ecoservice production function. So this determines whether or not a service is produced. Does the change determined by the response function result in greater recreational opportunities? Does the slowing of the water that we achieved in going from box one to box two actually result in any protection of flooding to downstream towns or crops? You can see that we're starting to incorporate some economic concepts that deal with supply and demand. Another way to think of it is in terms of thresholds. So these functions aren't necessarily, in fact, probably hardly ever going to be linear. So we might do a management activity that increases density of a forest by 20%, and that's an interesting measurement, but that 20% only can matter to whether or not an ecosystem goods and services are being produced if it's not some kind of threshold whereby that density is actually helping to slow the water down. So perhaps going from 0 to 20% doesn't really slow the water down that much, but going from 20 to 60% is a threshold that actually makes a big difference in how water flows and gets interrupted in eddies and that type of thing. So these production functions are not generally linear, and they need to be founded in good science and economics. And then finally, next slide, going to between the last two boxes, going from your ecosystem goods and service to your social benefits, you do that via a benefit or damage function, depending on whether you're having a negative or positive impact. and that determines the value of the change in the service. So while an ecosystem good or service might be additional angler days or houses that are now outside the five-year floodplain because of flood protection, the social benefits are going to be the monetary value of those or some proxy for that. As long as the ecosystem goods or service function itself incorporates a human perspective, monetizing is not always necessary or actually even desirable. So that has been a very sort of quick and dirty overview of sort of the state of the science right now and a little bit about our framework for how we're thinking about doing this in the court. It's very generalizable, so you can see that it's not just for nature-based infrastructure, but it can be used for that as well as many of our other types of projects. And it's also general enough that actually it's not very core-specific. Any of our partners could use the same framework. And that ends my presentation, and I pass it on to Kelly.
Okay, thanks. This is Dave. Again, just thank you very much, Elizabeth. We're going to transition presentation. Going to speak a little bit about developing ecosystem goods and services metrics for natural and nature-based infrastructure specific to the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. Kelly is a research ecologist from U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Army Research, Army Engineer Research and Development Center in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Kelly's been with the Corps for over 19 years and has conducted numerous research studies spanning the gamut of ecosystem restoration, flood risk management, regulatory mitigation banking, climate change, sea level rise, and coastal storm damage risk assessments. Kelly has a BS and MS in ecology, and in her spare time, she's working on her PhD in interdisciplinary ecology, hoping to defend in November of this year. So Kelly is one of the 30 staff members and researchers in the Army Research Development Center and the Institute of Water Resources here in the Corps, working on the natural and nature-based infrastructure efforts for the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. She is also the lead for ecosystem goods and services work, focused on developing the qualitative and quantitative performance metrics for the North Atlantic Coast study team. So with that, I'll pass it off to Kelly. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dave. I want to tell everybody who's on the phone trying to look at the slides that if you're seeing the slides cut off, you need to go to the View pull-down menu and look at the shared application display and say fit to whiteboard, and then you will see the entire slide. And I just wanted to warn you that they'll get cut off if you don't do that. So again, thank you for that introduction, Dave. Yes, I am a research ecologist in the Engineer Research and Development Center, but I'm not the only one who worked on this. There was a pretty big team of interdisciplinary research ranging from hydrodynamic coastal modelers to ecologists to economics folks on the team. And so what I'm going to present to you is the work that we've been doing for the last 3.5 to 4 months. We started in the May timeframe. And I'll present what we did, and then we'll talk about the path forward. So the natural and nature-based scope had three tasks. One of them was to characterize the NBI. The second task was data integration and coming up with metrics, both performance metrics and vulnerability metrics. And then the third task was looking at how to use those metrics in an evaluation framework and actually establishing that. The goal of the entire study down here was basically to work on a scientifically defensible justification for incorporating natural and nature-based features into the current management schemes and start thinking about what they might bring to the table in a more holistic approach. So we're going to talk about task two and specifically the performance metrics that have been developed for natural and nature-based infrastructure. But I want to point out one thing. Since the last call, I realized that Paul Wagner probably presented a fairly in-depth description of nature-based features. There is now a green paper that has been released as of August, and it was just about a week and a half ago, that lays out
natural and nature-based features, along with non-structural and structural solutions. And the intent is to look at not only the flood risk management benefits that one might achieve by looking at this kind of full breadth of different approaches one might go about to work on the flood risk damage reduction aspect, but to actually look at the full range of environmental, social, economic, and flood risk benefits that might be generated as we put these features on the land. So in that green paper, there is a definition that talks about the intentioned use of natural and engineered features to produce these functions, and that they produce a large or a wide breadth of ecosystem services and social benefits. The intent here is to focus on the broad spectrum of features, the fact that they are engineered or also natural-based, and that they can take a variety of forms. And they have, inside that paper, something called natural and nature-based infrastructure at a glance. And it gives you an idea of the wealth or the breadth of what we're looking at. It's everything from dunes and beaches all the way up to barrier islands and oyster reefs and vegetative features like living shorelines. So think in those terms when you start talking about how you're going to reduce risks to flooding and coastal storms, but also how are you going to be able to compare and contrast plans with these different features involved. And so what we need is a set of performance metrics, basically specific measures that we can use consistently over and over and over again to estimate the report and report out the anticipated consequences of a particular plan. So we need to be able to compare and contrast plans. We can't make these metrics really complicated. They have to be very straightforward. They need to be complete and concise, unambiguous, accurate, direct, understandable, but also operational. We need to be able to deploy these very quickly. So what we're talking about is a series of metrics that characterize ecosystem goods and services. So by definition, we are defining those as tangible and intangible commodities that are generated by self-regulating or managed systems, and they have a particular composition, structure, and function that are comprised of all of those features, so natural, nature-based, and or structural. And what they do is produce socially valued benefits that can be either directly used or indirectly used to basically promote human welfare. Okay? The key points here in the definition is that we can get, and we should be measuring, ecosystem goods and services derived from built or natural capital or both together in a combination, and that valuing them is basically a way of depicting their importance and their desirability to local communities and to the region and national community at large. And then the ability to, for these ecosystems to be able to produce these goods and services is dependent on the structure and the function of these features all in concert or alone. So what we're talking about is basically driving forces. We can look at structural features or natural and nature-based features affecting the ecosystem, the structure and composition. And that structure and that composition has a particular function or provides a particular function or process. Those produce what we call goods and services. And those goods and services provide benefits to the human population. Okay? Those benefits have a perceived value, and those values then affect the policy and guidance that we establish to deploy nature-based features and structural features in combination or separately. So we had about 4 months to pull all of the metrics together that we could find. We used something called a spiral-based approach, which is that we started off with a problem definition, and we worked forward, but we also looked back recursively to start building or cobbling together different metrics that could be used. We had to identify the critical features that we were supposed to be measuring, and so that involved everything from the structural side of the house, the kind of the gray infrastructure side of the house, to these nature-based and natural features, and then tie goods and services directly to the processes and functions, basically their structure and composition generating the processes and functions that then generated these services. Once we knew the services, we could then create a series of metrics. It doesn't have to to be just one metric, it can be multiple metrics, to be able to quantify, either quantify or qualitatively describe the benefits that are coming out of those services. It's a spiral-based approach, which means that we look backwards and forwards as we're moving through the process. And the intention is to, first of all, develop trust in the community, to start understanding what green infrastructure is versus what nature-based infrastructure is versus what structural infrastructure is, learn to articulate our systems and be able to describe what we've done, and then finally start to understand goods and services in the context in which it's going to be used. Everything that we've developed to date is adaptive, which means that if we get into a situation in the future where they're ready to deploy these metrics and they need to be fine-tuned, that's absolutely appropriate and anticipated. So what we've developed is the beginning with the understanding that we're going to be moving forward and honing these as needed. So the first step was basically deciding which features we were talking about. Nature-based and natural features were listed and worked through and aggregated and split. And so we ended up with a list of 19. They go in a kind of a gradient from the water up, and there are actually some in the water and some on the land. There are beaches, mudflats, everything from the maritime forest to the terrestrial forest upland. We're looking at dune soil complexes. We're looking at swamp forests and herbaceous marshes, but also salt marshes. So we're looking at fresh and salt together. You see these complexes on, you see these individual features on the landscape, but they don't operate independently. They operate as a system. And so we started clustering these into complexes. So you'll have a reef or an reef intertidal and submerged all together with maybe some sprinkling of structural features inside, like breakwaters, for example. Barrier islands include the backside and the front side and everything up on the top. So we came up with another 5 to 6 different nature-based complexes that we needed to look at. And then we looked at specific built features that we knew were being considered as measures for this study. So levees and storm surge barriers, seawall groins, and breakwaters. Those in mind, we started listing out the services that we had found in the literature that had been associated with these different features. And so on the screen right now, you're seeing a list of 21 services that we've been able to kind of cull from the literature, and they're presented alphabetically, not by value preference. In other words, there are 5 that are highlighted that are likely to be primary mission concerns for post-Sandy recovery. Those are the services that are directly associated with flood damage reduction or flood reduction. So everything from reducing storm surge and reducing wave attacks to controlling or protecting from erosion and doing some property value evaluations, so protection, basically. But there's, you know, with these kind of structural features that we've been talking about, sometimes there's very little other services that are offered. But if you start thinking about deploying taking a nature-based approach or a natural and nature-based approach, you're likely to see an increase in services because there's other services that are provided year-round that may come into play or may come into a decision-making paradigm so that you can start choosing or selecting complexes that give you the wealth and breadth of the services that are offered. So those are the services that are not highlighted but are also of concern for the area. It's everything from a kind of a generic aesthetics category to, at the very bottom of the list, threatened and endangered species protection. So I want to, you know, emphasize this list is alphabetical. It's not in terms of preference, of anyone's preference, but it could be used as a launch point to start assessing different features that are considered for these risk recovery efforts. We took the list of features, and we took the list of services, and we married them up. And then we did a tabular approach that basically said for each given feature, what are the influential components that affect and produce functions and processes that then provide a particular service that has a series of benefits, and then we generated metrics for those benefits. And we did this over and over again for each component and each function and each service and each benefit and each metric for each of the 21 services and 30 features. So what we ended up with is a series of tables for each feature. So for example, on the screen is the beach. It's the sand, gravel, or cobble beach, or a combination of them. There are influential components, substrate, for example, that provides the geomorphological diversity of the natural ecosystem components that provides aesthetics. And those aesthetics can be measured in terms of scenic beauty. So we can develop a metric that basically measures scenic beauty by looking at population density and the size of the features. This is the kind of approach that we've developed thus far. So there is a spreadsheet for every single feature. What we can do with that right off the bat is we can start looking at different plans in different settings. And we can ask the question, on the top right is a matrix that is basically plans on the top and services down the y-axis. And what we can do is put a feature in and ask the question what services are provided. We can put in a second feature and ask, again, what services are provided. And they can be sorted by, let's say, flood damage reduction and biodiversity or something like that. Some kind of typology can be used to make sense of the outcome. The alternative is something different, maybe, an entirely different plan, and ask the question, what services are generated or derived from putting that in place? We can take another approach and add things to it, cobble it together plan, and start asking the question, what are the width and breadth services that we're seeing as we put these features on the ground? Or we can look at it as an entire complex and see the return on services, the return on investment based on services, as a conglomerate of everything, putting together all the services. So we can make this very difficult or we can make this very easy. We could use a matrix like I just showed you. We could put experts in the room, stakeholders in the room, collaborators in the room, and we could ask them to take a look at the design, and they could literally check off the boxes for which services are being provided by each of these features, and then we could ask them preferentially for them to value those services. In their opinion, service X is this valuable under this design. And then you can relatively weight these in 5,000 different ways to basically show a mean score, some kind of weighted score at the end, and that would give you a qualitative evaluation of service provision as a result of the different alternative plans. We could also look at it in a more systematic way and do something called causal mapping. Now, this is semi-quantitative. It involves conceptual modeling. So basically, we go through and we highlight what benefits are being produced by what services, by what functions, by what components, and by what features. And we can draw pathways between each of these to show, and it's obviously very messy, that there is no singular pathway to a particular benefit, that different features provide that benefit different ways and in different manners. And you can actually start mapping these out. You can look at these are the structural features, or you can take a look at the natural features and the nature-based features in combination. And if you're interested in a particular service and a particular benefit, you can map through these causal maps or causal diagrams exactly how one might go about producing that benefit, and then consider which features to put on the landscape to generate that benefit. And you can do this qualitatively, again, with these kind of connections, but you can also put scientifically based data behind these boxes and start calculating a return on the investment in terms of benefits. So you could get a score as a result of putting different features on the landscape. The point of this is that it's a very messy system, and so there are over 400 causal arguments that can be related thus far in our exercise, and we've only been doing this for about 4 months. So if you can imagine, this could get very messy very quick. One of the things that we can do, though, is focus on a particular pathway and then generate answers as a result of that. And so it will allow us to do some quantification of the benefits. But what it also does, and what's really critical about doing this, is that it lays out the interconnectivity of the system to anybody in the room. And that way, they can start seeing that it is a system and not just an individual feature providing a particular service. The last thing we did is develop a series of quantitative metrics that could be used in the planning study to characterize the services using GIS-based data and literature. One of the things that we've been focusing on are the study planning reaches and focusing on generating baselines for each of those reaches for each of the services that we've been doing. And we've come up with two separate ways of characterizing the service returns. One of them is called value transfer or benefit transfer, which is basically placing a dollar value on features. In other words, how much the features cost relative to literature. So there's actually literature out there that says there's a certain value that these different features provide to the landscape. And we can put dollars on that. And remember, this is based purely on literature review. So these are can be adjusted as necessary. Alternatively, we can use GIS-based procedures to map the systems and use different geoprocessing tools to characterize the features in terms of spatial context. And so thus far, using this strategy, we've developed 72 individual performance metrics that are ready for the next phase, which means that they're ready to go and can be used to compare and contrast different plans on the landscape under the different, I know that we're not getting recommendations out of the reconnaissance study, but we are getting ideas about measures or features or things that could be put in place. And these techniques and tools, all three, the qualitative, the semi-quantitative, and this quantitative approach, can be used to give a value to the return on investment that can be used to compare and contrast the different designs. So we have produced a draft white paper on this entire topic, and we've provided that to the district for review, and it's coming back, and we should be in a position to finalize that white paper on August, I think it's on August 3rd. It says August 6th, but I think we're going to shoot for a little bit earlier than that. And we are certainly welcoming review comment on that from the district, and then if anybody else would like to give us some comments, we're open to that. What I want to close with is the idea that this is a reconnaissance level investigation, that we had to do this very quickly, and that there's 7 ways to Sunday to basically do what we've done. And so there's more investigation that still needs to be done. We're not really clear yet on what the stakeholders are considering in terms of their measures, whether they're structural or nature-based or some kind of composite. We're not sure how effective these solutions are yet, and so those are still questions that are being answered, and there's some cost-effective questions. One of the other earlier tasks in the scope was looking at the costs of putting these features into place. And so cost evaluation is going to be critical to deciding what's the cost-effective solution. So here's what's important to realize. We're on the frontier of science doing this. Nature-based solutions and goods and services both are frontier sciences. And so these things are very uncertain and slightly risky, if you want to say it that way. And so there's always room for improvement and always advancements to come. And the perceptions of few stakeholders and the cluster sponsors and the core, the federal government, state, and local organizations, even NGOs, the values perceived or arriving from these services are not clear or even, you can't pull this off of a map or a list and say that's what it is, because there's perceived values that change as the economic status of the region changes, as the status of, let's say, the species that are of concern change. And so all of this is very fluid and very, I guess we'll have to be very recursive or reflective in how we value what we're producing. And so that is something that I want to point out is still to come. These are the kinds of things that you can't just nail down right off the bat. We're going to have to work on this to get to the end. And with that, anyone who has questions after this, and I will definitely entertain those on the call, but if you want to have an offline conversation, this is my contact information, and with that, I am done.
A lot.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Melanie, and thank you, Kelly. Very, very good presentation. So, with that, let's move into our third and final presentation for today before getting into the question and answer session. Ms. Lisa Wanger will be available here to provide an overview of the application of ecosystem goods and services to coastal restoration projects in as part of three case studies. And so with that, just a brief introduction for Lisa. Lisa is a research professor of environmental economics at the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. Lisa's primary research interest is in developing integrated ecological and economic analysis tools to measure changes in ecological conditions in terms of their social benefits. Lisa has over 20 years of experience working nationally and internationally with government agencies, NGOs, and private firms as well to promote cost-effective restoration targeting and ecosystem service benefits assessments. So with that, Lisa, I'm going to drive your presentation.
Great, thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks for the introduction. Okay, so we're going to shift gears a little bit here. It's nice that you've had now the framework presented and a lot of the methods introduced through Kelly. And what this presentation brings to the mix is a way to think about how you might apply this when you get down to the site scale. So obviously some possibilities open up as you can look at the very specific activities going on. So hopefully what you'll get out of this presentation are kind of the state of the data and tools for doing site-specific analyses. So even though I'll focus on these three case studies, the goal is to help you see that there are ways that are not too complex to demonstrate benefits of a proposed or existing site. Next slide, please. So it is important to understand this really is a proof of concept analysis. As Elizabeth said, I've been involved in developing an ecosystem goods and services analysis framework, and so this was the first time we've tried to apply that to core projects. And you know, the key test here is, do we really have enough data and understanding to really create these benefit metrics? So we use the same techniques one does for any kind of economic value assessment, that you're trying to assess the performance of a project relative to a no-action baseline. So that's what helps you understand the effect of the project. And then the relationship to Hurricane Sandy is that we took these existing projects and we thought, well, if we could use the data that's been collected in terms of their performance under Hurricane Sandy, that would potentially help us understand the benefits. We had a very limited time period, 2 months, to do this analysis. So we hope that we will be able to refine these numbers and methods in the year to come. But this is the quick and dirty, if you will. Next slide, please. So the three case studies are distributed along the NACS area. And so Jamaica Bay is up there in the north, and that project is primarily an island wetland restoration project. Then moving down the coast to New Jersey, we have the Cape May Meadows site, where it's actually a variety of things done there, but I've highlighted dune creation and beach nourishment as part of it, but there was also wetland enhancement. And then the southernmost site, Cape Charles, is the simplest site. It's a series of offshore breakwaters, but was of interest because of some endangered species habitat in that area. Next slide, please. So these three sites, we have three sites and one hurricane. These three sites cover a range of intensities of Hurricane Sandy effects. So this graphic that Scott Bourne created shows the maximum gauge height recorded. So the Cape Charles site is still under the effect of Hurricane Sandy, but at a much lower magnitude than the New York and New Jersey sites. Next slide, please. So as part of implementing this in 2 months, we took the framework that we've been developing and streamlined it. And the framework really is intended to be streamlinable because we recognize that the approach has to be right-sized to the resources and sort of level of project investment. So that was relatively simple to do, but what that meant was that we didn't necessarily have as much time to, say, consult with stakeholders. We were using a lot of existing materials, and ideally, you know, you'd want more opportunities to do some of the things that Kelly described. But in the meantime, what we were able to do with these projects was, from talking to stakeholders and from existing documents, identify which ecosystem services were of potential interest, choose the best metrics for measuring those. So there were some things it was obvious we'd be able to monetize, other things we thought we could only quantify. We reserved the right to do qualitative descriptors, although I think we ended up quantifying everything. And then you get into that framework that Elizabeth presented, where you're first trying to assess what are the biophysical changes due to the project. That's the response function. Then we start getting into the economic benefits assessment that breaks down into two parts, essentially, that we want to understand for any given user of a service or any beneficiary of a service, what is the sort of per person change in value as a result of the change in the site. So we call that the unit value, and I'll give you some examples in a minute. And then you have to assess how many people have been affected, so how many people's values are changing. And then at step six, we recognize that not everything's going to be monetized, and for these, and primarily these services are what we've lumped under the ecosystem sustainability services. They're things that people value, but they're not necessarily directly using. So that whole idea of per-user value doesn't really work. So we have other ways of quantifying the importance of changes in those ecosystems. And then, you know, the big effort is to try to show how all those change relative to the without project baseline. Next slide, please. So here's where we started with this kind of chart, and this basically follows what I just said, where you've got the services in each row. We identified the biophysical metric we would use to assess project performance from an ecological or physical perspective, and then we looked at the unit value for things that are being used and the market size where appropriate, and then we finally came up with a final metric. So let me walk you through, say, this property enhancement service, where the biophysical metric was, and what this refers to is that we know that property values are higher where there are certain natural amenities, and it's been demonstrated that beach width has an effect on home value. So it's not just having a beach there, but having a wider beach is more valuable. So the biophysical metric of interest was the change in beach width, which is also correlated with a change in erosion, part of where the value comes from. And then we wanted to look at, okay, for a given change in beach width, how much effect does that have on property value? That's our sort of unit value, and it's represented as a percentage. But then we have to also say, okay, which are the properties that are under the influence of a given beach, and then we can use that to generate a value of the property enhancement. And so we have a mix in this right-hand column of dollar values and quantitative metrics, and I'll show you some more of those. Next slide, please. So starting with these biophysical metrics, what did the data look like? What were we able to measure? This is the Cape Charles South site, and this is really sort of showing you some of the challenges. So what we have, you can probably see there's some offshore breakwaters, some beach, you know, beaches developed behind those breakwaters. And then the blue polygon is showing you the maximum storm surge under Hurricane Sandy. So if we're looking to demonstrate how the project affects storm surges, we're not really seeing that in this data, that we have plenty of flooding behind the project. It's pretty difficult to make that link. And, you know, I'm sure there's folks that can really appreciate that on the call. So it doesn't necessarily mean there wasn't an effect, but it does mean that with the data we have, you are not able to demonstrate an effect. And so we're not able to improve upon pre-existing studies that looked at probabilities of flooding risk and potential effects. So this was service we were not able to analyze. Next slide, please. And what you'll see here is I'm just giving you some interesting examples. I'm not going to try to be comprehensive because that would just take too long, but I'm showing you how we dealt with the data challenges and where we found some successes. So that was perhaps not one of our successes, but here's another case where we wanted a biophysical metric in Cape May Meadows of how the beach had changed. And we didn't find that monitoring data were going to serve our need. So what we did was use Google Earth imagery. There's a time series of Google Earth imagery that can help you look at how beaches have changed over time. It's not ideal, but it was a start. And so we created these markers in the GIS showing the shoreline edge for the project site there on the left and for a control site on the right. Next slide, please. And then we looked at how those markers moved, or rather how the beach the shoreline moved relative to those markers. So the markers are the pre-project condition, and then we looked at how all those markers moved. So what this box and whiskers diagram is showing you on the left-hand side are the movement of all the project markers for the project site, and on the right-hand side for the control site. And anything above the dashed line is net accretion, anything below is net erosion. And then I'm also showing you where the blue arrow, upward arrow, shows when the project went into effect. So you see that both the project site and the control site had enhanced accretion after 2005 when the project went in, even though the control site was not under the influence of the project. So as you all know, beaches are very dynamic, and it's very difficult to say, yes, it's exactly this amount of change due to the project. But through an analysis of the average beach accretion since the project at the project site versus the control site, we could see that there was an additional, actually several meters of accretion at the project site compared to the control site. So using that information, we estimated that the additional beach width due to the project was about 14 meters over this time period. So that's a substantial, you know, biophysical change that we can put into our modeling and use. Next slide, please. Another example in talking to the stakeholders at Jamaica Bay, they told us that they had a sense that the island creation projects going on in this bay were protecting some of the infrastructure from wave action and during storms. And so we didn't have a complex, you know, model to help us really evaluate that. So we thought, well, an indicator of wave energy at any given point is the horizontal fetch, and that's the distance of open water in the direction of wind. So it's not a perfect metric, but it is a simple way to show that these island projects are reducing at least this one element of that contributes to wave energy in certain directions. So that was our other metric that we used for biophysical, for the service of protecting critical infrastructure. Next slide, please. Okay, so leaving behind the biophysical metrics, now we're getting into how do we do monetary valuation. And I'm going to go back to that service of property value enhancement that I mentioned before. We used economic benefit transfer. So this is when you take primary valuation studies that have been done through data analysis or surveys, and you transfer them to sites that haven't been directly studied. And your ideal for this is to have someone who's looked at all the literature and created a benefit transfer function, essentially a meta model of all the studies, so that you can understand how things vary based on site characteristics. When we looked at the literature, we found that there weren't enough studies to develop that kind of transfer function. So instead, we used the other kind of benefit transfer you can do, which is to take an average value or a single comparable study value and transfer it. We happened to find a study that was a very good match. It was done in New York and for a very similar type of setting. So we just took that one study's value in terms of how beach width affected properties. And although there was a range depending on beach width, we compared it to our beach width and picked a more conservative estimate of 0.3% increase in home value per foot of beach added at this range, because it is a nonlinear function, as you can imagine. To add a meter to a small beach has generally more value than adding a meter to a large beach. So we took that into account when we chance value. Next slide, please. And then the next step was to identify the properties under the influence of this value enhancement. And we got this directly from our literature analyses that, obviously effect is sort of a decay function from the beach, but to keep the analysis simple at this time, we just took the half-meter buffer, which is where the effect starts to peter out, essentially, and took an average value over that instead of making it more complex. So this is showing you in the GIS how we identified the projects that were within a half mile, half mile of the project, and we were able to find a database that had the values of those parcels, and then we could estimate what proportion of that value was likely due to the beach. and likely due to the project specifically enhancing the beach. So that's what that 1.7 million figure is showing you. So that's already compared to the baseline because we're only adding the percentage of value that's due to the beach width increase. Yep, yep. Okay, so that's an example of something we were able to value. Next slide, please. But then we also recognize there are a lot of services that we are not going to be able to monetize. And so what we really want to do for our ecosystem sustainability metrics is, you know, break that down into important components. In this case, we thought about species biodiversity as well as ecosystem diversity that was enhanced by the projects. And then we want to show that this project in this location is more important than other projects in other locations. And so, you know, or not. I mean, the point is to assess that value. And so these are some examples of some recently released data that we found useful. On the left-hand side, we used the bison database that's being created by the USGS that shows species occurrences. It's, of course, everyone knows the species occurrence databases, they're never complete, but we were able at this site to find almost all our species of concern in the database, and it suggested to us that the project at Jamaica Bay was potentially enhancing 85% of the species of concern in this area, habitat for 85% of the species. So that, we thought, was a very nice metric to be able to generate from that. On the ecosystem diversity side, we applied a database that's been created for the EPA Enviro Atlas, which folks may not be familiar with, but is a large database that's being created to assist folks looking to measure ecosystem goods and services. And in particular, we focused on this rare ecosystems file, which it takes a while to explain how the metric was created, so I'm not going to try to do that here. But essentially, this is showing nationally rare ecosystems, and it shows that they are represented in our study area. Now, of course, you often find your actual project restorations, which I don't have highlighted here, but are the areas that aren't showing up with the yellow highlighted rare ecosystems. You're never going to find your brand new well and creation in the database showing something rare or some element occurrence of a species because they weren't there when the database was created. So you have to make an inference that if you're creating the same kind of habitat that is, or the same kind of ecosystem, that you are enhancing that service. So that's how we approached that, and we were able to come up with some quantitative metrics from those kinds of data. Next slide, please. And then another example, this comes from Landscope Chesapeake, a project that the Nature Service is developing, where they're mapping conservation priorities. And I'm sure folks have seen other data like this before. You know, we decided we could make a metric showing the relative importance of the site by characterizing the quantity that was in the highest priority categories. So we came up with a metric of 8 acres in the highest priority categories, either within or adjacent to the project, with the idea that things adjacent are being, you know, protected and buffered by the project. So that's another example. Next slide, please. So here's what the results look like. So every site had a different table because different services were important in different sites and different data were available in different sites. So, but this shows that we were able to, for 4 or 5 services, come up with some quantitative metrics that ranged from everything from how many commuting hours could potentially be saved by protecting infrastructure to dollar values of carbon sequestered. And this represents, you know, a fair bit of work to try to nail down all these biophysical changes and these value changes and these benefit metrics. But, you know, given that we had 2 months, I think it turned out to be fairly reasonable and fairly robust. So, I won't go through all these details, but be happy to answer questions. So the next slide, I'll just give you a few take-homes of this analysis. I think the state of the science at this point does support, and the databases that are available do support, the generation of reasonable metrics that let you compare sites. The metrics you can create are nationally comparable, generalizable, but we also know not necessarily very precise. They're not tailored to the location details. For example, in that last slide I just showed you, the endangered species habitat that I spoke of didn't show up as a high conservation priority, and that these sorts of things can just get washed out. Either they're not in the data used or they're at too fine a scale to show up given the algorithm used to create that map. And so obviously you have to use these things with caution, but they do provide some opportunities, and I think those opportunities are really expanding as more of these kinds of databases become available. Okay, so there are some services for which we had to make what we call heroic assumptions, and you'll often hear people who work in ecosystem services talk about heroic assumptions because you have a conceptual model that a certain ecosystem feature delivers a certain kind of change in the system, but actually quantifying that, demonstrating the effect, it can be very difficult. And so that's, you know, it just should be clear to folks that there are times where you can make very robust connections or perhaps use less heroic assumptions, but in some cases an effect you really think is there, you cannot quantify and you have to make to either represent or not represent. And obviously you have to choose where, what kind of context these data are being used in and whether that's appropriate. But I hope you can see that a lot of these methods and metrics are designed to be transferable, that even there's a lot of databases available to do monetary valuation, for example, recreational meta-analyses that allow you to easily put dollar values on recreational benefits, for example. It's pretty tractable to come up with metrics that are benefit indicators that take into account whether there are people using the service without necessarily trying to monetize it. I didn't necessarily get into some of those details, but not everything has to be monetized to be compelling to people, and a lot of the focus of this is developing non-monetary metrics that even non-specialists could understand represent benefits. So with that, I'll leave it at that and open things up to questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. We appreciate your presentation there. And at this point, it concludes our presentations from our three presenters this morning. We do want to enter into our question and answer period. I think the best way to approach this would be if you had specific questions on our presentations or to our presenters, that we focus on that, and then from there lead into more broader questions on how this could be applied going forward. But anyway, that's where we are, and I guess we're going to conclude the day at around 12 o'clock. So we have approximately 35 minutes of question and answer, and then from there we can begin wrapping up with about 5 minutes till 12 o'clock.
Hi, this is Sarah. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
Hi, this is Sarah Murdoch from the Nature Conservancy. This was a great WebEx, so thank you. Really informative. I have an initial question for Kelly. I was interested in how you might have taken into consideration the negative effects of some of the various features that you looked at. So you talked about quantifying the benefits, and I didn't hear how you were necessarily taking into consideration some of the negative features that some of the features, both natural and hard infrastructure that you looked at. And also, I guess involved in that is also a time frame consideration. So some of these features may not have an immediate benefit or negative impact over a short term, but if you looked at it over a longer term, they're going to have negative considerations come into play more.
Sarah, thank you for those questions. I've got some answers, and then I'll say that we are still learning through the process, but some of the answers, and let me just lay out maybe what I think might be negative aspects of, let's say, a nature-based feature, and then you can tell me if I'm on the track, okay? One of the concerns that's out there is that nature-based features are, and we have to acknowledge that they are sacrificial in nature. They are placed in a particular area where they're likely to see a great amount of wave action, and they are likely to be blown out when the big storm comes. And they do provide a degree of flood damage reduction. If they were not there, there would be much greater flooding. And so those types of things are being considered and addressed in terms of designs. They will be addressed in terms of designs, maybe in a manner that allows us to do backups or contingency planning, or we do it in compositions of multiple features so that there's a first line of defense, a second line of defense, and a third line of defense. So those things are being considered. There is an entire task in our effort looking at vulnerability. And we're focusing on the negative aspects in that particular task. So that's, they're developing vulnerability metrics that look at the negative side of this. And so that's being handled by a different team, but in concert with what my team was doing. So we already are kind of becoming aware of that. But a third negative thing out there is that if you were to, let's say, and I don't want to get in trouble here, but let's say that you put out a dune and vegetate it, and then that setting attracts threatened and endangered species, and therefore you run into a regulatory issue or a compliance issue with protection of those threatened and endangered species. Those issues are also being considered, and the idea of the ramifications of bringing that kind of setting to the fore, we're not disregarding that. We are thinking about those, and we're trying to kind of increase awareness of users on the end so that they become cognizant of these kind of secondary or cumulative effects of putting these things on the landscape. So those are being played out. The last thing is for the metrics, we are certainly not saying that all metrics are going to be positive. In fact, some of the metrics may be a negative return. And we're capturing that by saying that we're doing unitless analyses, and so we can say that a negative score would give us like a zero suitability index or something to that effect. So we're tracking those in terms of kind of a 0-1 scale, or it could be a 0-100 scale. We're allowing our end users to dictate the scale. So that's kind of how we're handling all of the different aspects of your question, unless I missed it.
No, I think you got it. I mean, is there an I think that captures it. I mean, we're certainly thinking about the negative impacts of gray infrastructure as well, which you didn't highlight in your response, and some of the negative habitat aspects of gray infrastructure. So I don't know if you've explicitly looked at those as well. And then in terms of the time frame, is there a set time frame, or you know, it sounds like you are looking at the longer term.
Right. Yeah. So I didn't answer the time frame question, and I will pass this over to Dave as well. But what I'm going to say is, the metrics are designed to be snapshot returns on benefit production, and therefore, what we can do in a planning setting is forecast future conditions based on the metrics production. And we can show that it takes a while for something to mature. For example, a wetland might be able to come online and take a few years to advance to the point at which it's at full productivity. That can be accounted for using things like the habitat evaluation procedure strategy, where they use target years to show an advancement of production over a series of years. And we have, in the core, we have a planning kind of horizon that looks at a 50-year outlook, but these metrics are indifferent to that. You could use these metrics and look 100 years out, or you could use these metrics and just look 10 years out. And so that's how we designed them, is to be incredibly flexible with regards to its utility, because for one, yes, the core might use these, but also the stakeholders might use these, and they may not be following particular core planning guidance. So we had to make them flexible enough that they could be used in both situations.
Okay, thank you, Kelly. And thank you, Sarah. Just to wrap up there, I think that, you know, as Kelly mentioned during her presentation, the work is coming together from various pieces. And so, really, to the timeline, you know, the information is coming together. We're integrating and reviewing the information as well concurrently at this point, and it's still being finalized is the point. And we're looking to be able to pull this together and make it useful for others going forward, similar to what Kelly was saying. And so that, again, the exact way that's going to occur is at this point still being developed. We're just getting the results of this great work so far. So there's more to come on this, but just wanted to touch base on the timeline there. So with that, let's go ahead and take the other verbal question, Melanie, if we could.
Carl Alderson, your line is open.
Okay, thank you very much. It took me a little time to figure that out. All right, thank you. This is one of the more high-tech webinars I've been part of. Thank you. It's probably because you have many participants on the line. So I have so many questions. I'll just start by saying that after the nor'easter of 1992 and I believe six deaths that occurred on the South Shore of Staten Island, the Army Corps entered into a South Shore of Staten Island study to determine best ways to create what wasn't then called resiliency, but could have been, for the communities there. At the time, there were X number of homes in affected areas, homes that had been flooded, homes where people had actually perished. The Corps got engaged in the study. I participated in some of the open meetings and early phases of that. By the time this study was complete, the Corps realized that many of the areas that had been wetlands were now built out as homes. In fact, the City of New York went on a campaign after the 92 storm to enlarge the sizes of the communities and to build new ones in what were some of the most vulnerable areas, not really taking heed of what they had learned from the storm at all, and much to the surprise of the leaders of the Corps study, there were now whole communities in what was considered the areas the Corps could take advantage of to build levees and structures to be protected. Come the Sandy storm, many of the over 1,000 new homes that were built in low-lying areas were highly damaged, and I believe 23 people got perished in Staten Island in this case, in homes that had not even existed until after the 92 storm. We didn't learn lessons from 92. We may not learn all our lessons from the Sandy storm or the subsequent nor'easters that also had great impact in December and beyond. I guess my question is, how can you be most effective in this excellent study, I want to compliment you on it, when you are dealing with so many municipalities, so many different political agendas and belief systems and how we should manage our shore areas, some communities wanting to build back in vulnerable areas, some communities retreating from vulnerable areas. How can we make this exercise more than an exercise? How important is it to get it done in a quick time frame? I believe my example demonstrates that that although the Corps was able to complete the study in some 5 years or so, it was already too late to affect change because changes were already being made all around them. How important is time frame, do you think, and the quickness and the speed at which you can get this study out? And then finally, how do you plan to outreach this study to make sure that all of these different municipalities are aware of its presence, aware of that results will be on the horizon, that there will be something of value at the end of this process? And do you think that you can execute it in time to make a difference? That's my question.
Okay, thank you. There are a few points in the discussion there. I just wanted to focus on a few of them. I guess you mentioned the scale at which we're working and the sheer number of stakeholders interested in what the Corps is doing here as part of the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study. Again, this we're at a very high level, and the purpose of which, and I think Amy spoke to this earlier on, is to develop a framework for identifying the vulnerable coastal populations and the ways to improve the resiliency along the coast. And so, again, this is a framework, and Kelly spoke to the framework specific to, you know, green infrastructure and the natural and nature-based infrastructure and how that plays a critical role as far as the metrics and in developing, you know, the benefits and services that those provide to the overall coastline. And so, again, it's in development as essentially as a tool going forward of how to implement that. And I guess as far as the timeline is concerned, we are also limited with the amount of detail that we can get down to. Again, this is a two-year study where we need to wrap up and deliver a report to Congress by January 2015. And so at this point in the scale which we're working, we don't have an opportunity to say we can really get to the details. And so as far as outreach is concerned, you know, we're working toward, developing, draft analyses. The work that's presented today is in and begin the socialization process, again, through these webinars, through some collaboration efforts with federal, tribal, local NGOs, et cetera. And once we have some information to begin socializing, we'll have discussions with those stakeholders in a little bit greater detail, and then ultimately delivering to Congress, it'll be a public document for consumption and use going forward. So hopefully that addresses a few questions. Moving on, if we could focus on a few of the economics questions we're receiving, specifically, again, how the ecosystem services can provide, you know, benefits in the terms of economics. And I think, you know, there was a question here regarding highly urbanized areas and how natural solutions may not be, I guess, as useful in those areas of the coastline. And I think that if, you know, Kelly, maybe if you could, or at least if you wanted to speak to this, but I guess Jamaica Bay was a case example where there was actually demonstrating some improvements in some ecological benefits, and as well as in the Cape May Meadows study of property value increases, not necessarily urban area like D.C. or Manhattan, for example, but there are opportunities to show that the nature-based infrastructure could provide some economic benefits. Maybe if I could pass that off to Kelly or Lisa to weigh in a little bit more on nature-based infrastructure in an urban setting.
Yes, I'm going to let Lisa take it. This is Kelly. I'll let Lisa take it, and then I'll fill in half that.
Yeah, I mean, really getting back to the original question, I think the person raised some pretty big issues, and that may be a little bit beyond what this analysis can demonstrate. What the analyses we're demonstrating can be used to set relative priorities. They can show whether projects have a net benefit. I think the larger issue of exactly where to target resources is in the realm of what we're doing, because we assume with these metrics that we're providing a method for comparing alternative investments. And ideally, they would bring in all the positives and negatives and help to target. But, of course, the tools are never as perfect as you want them to be. So there will still economic analyses, these kinds of analyses will just be inputs into a decision process that will have to take into account other effects as well.
I don't need to add anything unless you didn't get an answer.
No, very good. Thank you, Lisa. And I guess to follow up and focusing on an urban environment and infrastructure as well, I think there was a question here about, again, the impact of the economic base to existing hard infrastructure and those areas that aren't protected, for example, roads, port systems, and utilities. That may not be specific to our discussion today, but we are, and I think that ties back into Kelly's point about vulnerability. There is a separate vulnerability assessment being completed as part of the COMP study We'll actually have a separate webinar on that evaluation as well. So then I wanted to just note that the question was asked, and we'll kind of defer that going forward. But if we can move back to, let's see here. I believe there was a question again about the economics of the metrics. Excuse me. I'm looking at the question here about the dependent variables and independent variables that that went into the function. It's likely that these variables are likely to be nonlinear. So I guess how the production function is going to take shape. Is there any way to address that question? And I guess this would be to Kelly, I believe.
Actually, I think the nonlinearity was brought up by both Elizabeth and by Lisa, so I'm going to let them discuss that a bit, and then I'll come back and talk about the dependent-independent variable.
I can take that if you want, Elizabeth. So I think really our emphasis with the nonlinearities, and obviously to really do this well, you do need to consider probabilities of outcomes. As you move forward at projecting into the future, there's a lot more complexity to the calculations than we represented here. But our key point with the nonlinearities was that we want to target the areas where you get the most bang for your buck, essentially. And so if you don't understand those nonlinearities, you don't make some attempt to represent them, you can end up wasting your effort by putting resources into an area, say, that's highly degraded where your project isn't really enhanced, or conversely, where the site was doing very well without you, you know. So you want to find that happy middle, usually, where there's a great opportunity to really improve some services through your actions and of course, do them in the process. So that's, I mean, obviously, there's a lot that goes into those calculations. I appreciate the question. You know, we do really want to focus on what are the data to tell us how well these sites are performing. Speaking for, you know, my piece of the project, we want to make sure that these are evidence-based metrics, and we'll work that with, you know, not ideal data. So.
Okay, Kelly, did you want to address anything regarding the variables, the dependent and independent variables?
Right. So I think that the bulk of the variables that we're looking at are scaled. He's asking actually how they're scaled and whether they're nonlinear or not. Our scores so far that we use when we use the GIS-based approach, they are scored or scaled on a scale of 0 to 1 normalized based on a variety of independent measures of function that we then compare to the dependent variables. So that's kind of how we did, and we made a lot of assumptions with respect to an increase in production function as a result of a change in the feature. And so those are all, what I want to say is flexible. In other words, we can fine tune or hone those as we move from area to area and the situation calls for it. So that's one of the things to be aware of. The second thing to be aware of is that the question of the urban versus the non-urban is still kind of lingering out there. The production functions are designed to assess not only the benefits that might come about from putting structural versus, well, nature-based or natural, we're looking at structural solutions as well, and in composite with the nature-based. The idea is that it's probably unlikely one or the other will serve the best for the community. We may end up having to do a combination of the two to get us there. And in the very urban settings, we completely admit that a lot of those solutions are going to be structural features. Those structural features, though, and I will say my team's been arguing about this for quite a bit now, have ecosystem goods and services that can be tied to them. They have some aesthetic value. They have some education values. They have value to improve the property values of the area. They have the potential to improve the property values of the area. So it's not to say that structural features don't produce ecosystem goods and services. In fact, they do. What we're saying is that that in combination with nature-based solutions, they might have more services provided.
And Kelly, were you finished with that?
Yes.
I was trying to jump in earlier, and I was still on mute. This is Elizabeth. I just wanted to touch base one more. I was the first one to bring up nonlinearity, and I just wanted to mention one other issue, which is one of the reasons that I bring it up is that usually the default position when we don't have data is to assume linearity, and that's a particularly bad assumption in this case. I mean, I think in most ecological systems it's not a good assumption, but it's often the default assumption, and so I wanted to make that point because as you're moving across from left to right in that framework and you're sort of processing from your biophysical data to your ecosystem service production, and then to your monetized function, any of those could be nonlinear. And just as an example, if you have one of the common sort of ecosystem benefit numbers that's thrown out there in the popular press is that for every mile of salt marsh that you have going out into the ocean, that you can decrease wave energy or you can decrease your wave height by 1 foot. And that's true. But does that actually lead to protection from flooding? Well, if your wave is only 1 or 2 feet to start with, then yes, it can have a tremendous effect. It can be the difference between something being overtopped and something not being overtopped. But if you've got a 10-foot wave, whether or not your levee is overtopped by 8 feet or by 9 feet is probably not relevant. And so you can see that's what I'm talking about in terms of nonlinearity of the eco-service production function. You might have a biophysical effect that is linear, at least within a certain range of values, but there's usually these thresholds that are need to be looked at when you're dealing with the eco-service, the actual benefit to society, and so that's where the nonlinearity often comes from.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it. Oh, very good, Elizabeth. Thank you. Just a two quick questions to answer, and then maybe we can take a few verbal questions. There was a question whether the information would be available for review. In the response back to us, I think there was a similar question. Yes, the information will be available upon completion of the study, but again, we're going to have targeted information and discussions with our groups to meet with our stakeholders, which is required in our authorization. With the federal, state, tribal, NGOs, et cetera, to have some information sharing and targeted discussion similar to what is occurring today. And as well, there's another question regarding the availability of this webinar. Again, we're going to post this information to the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive website. That information, I believe, was sent out to all earlier on in the presentation, should be in your notes transcript. So with that, maybe, Melanie, if you could take the next verbal question, please.
In the meantime, we do have another question in the queue from Carl Alderson. Please go ahead.
Hi, if Dan's still trying to get his phone up and running, I'll fill mine out. I just wanted to comment on the study that was done that shows the reduction in or lack of reduction by wetlands over, and a good example, the mile and a 1 foot reduction in height. I read that study, and what struck me was that at the end of the study, the authors seemed to suggest that it was site-specific, condition-specific, that there was not a one-size-fits-all. Clearly, in their study, they were using examples like Louisiana Bayou. One thing that characterizes marshes, those types are homogeneous topography. There's unending similar topography, a similar elevation across the length of those marshes. What struck me was that using that study, I think we could devise more undulating topographies, not heterogeneous topographies that would include marshes, berm breaks, marsh islands and such, and that the overall effect might not reduce height so much, but may reduce velocity of an oncoming large-scale wave. And that's the critical part here. If we are to face a storm of this magnitude again, it's not only the height, but your horizontal energy, your velocity, the oncoming surge that can be knocked down. So at least to take out some of that, the potential destruction from the oncoming wave. That may be a great lesson learned and there are probably, I would say you could look at neighborhood examples in low-lying areas that were not affected, that were surrounded by marshes of that type, and you might be able to study the effects of those type of topographies and why those communities were going about their business the day after the storm, picking up trees and whatnot, but not tearing their homes down, taking the water out of their basements or their first floor, and why that was, even though those communities were surrounded by marshes. Very interesting, and I think it plays into that recent study about how it is all about condition, direction of storm, the physical topography, a lot of factors that make that generalization only so good as a rule of thumb. That's just what I want to point out there. Thanks.
This is Kelly. I can address that issue to some extent. The vulnerability assessment that's being led by Ty Wamsley, and I believe Dave mentioned that there's going to be a follow-on, maybe even the next webinar or later, that discusses this topic specifically. The vulnerability assessment group looked at everything from geology, solid and drift, to landforms, to elevations, to significant wave heights, tidal ranges, differences in the modal and the storm waves, frequency of the onshore storms, morphodynamic state, and then a whole bunch of socioeconomic factors that had to do with how the landscape behind these features was arrayed. And so they're not using that rule of thumb. They're using the full width and breadth of all of the geomorphological and coast hydrology conditions to characterize the vulnerability of these different features going into play.
Okay, thank you, Kelly. Good discussion there. Melanie, if we could have the next verbal question, please.
Yes, I believe now we have Daniel Mundy on the line. Daniel, please go ahead.
Hi, this is Dan Mundy from the Jamaica Bay Eco Watchers, and first I'd like to compliment you on a great job today. It's just a tremendous amount of information being disseminated here. Rob, I have more of a point of information, and it's in regards to the cost analysis and the benefits of marsh restoration, particularly what we've seen here in Jamaica Bay. I'm the president of the Jamaica Bay Eco Watches, and we've been involved in all of the marsh restoration projects in Jamaica Bay for the last 15 years. And they've been a tremendous success here, really a tremendous success. But what I want to bring up is that in the very beginning, the first marsh restoration projects were comprehensive and very expensive, costing almost $1 million an acre to restore. And so I'd like to point out that for the people that are going to be doing the future studies in regards to this, is that the project that we're involved in right now, and I was out there this morning before the webinar come on, working on it, is that we're doing it a lot of it with volunteers. Normally, it's very labor intensive, and through a volunteer project here, taken on by the American Little Society and the Jamaica Bay Eco Watchers, we have in the process right now of restoring 30 acres of marshland right out my window here, and we're doing it for probably it's going to come out to about $200,000 an acre, down from the $1 million an acre that was done in the past. And the way this has been accomplished is that we've used the federal money and the co-share monies, the 65-35% between the city and the federal government, and that was used to bring the sand in and placement of the sand, which is nobody can do that except the Army Corps of Engineers, of course, and that's what they're greatest at, and they really do a tremendous job. But after that, it's very labor-intensive hand planting of the Spartina alterna 4. We just completed planting 88,000 plugs of them on 10 acres, and then we've seeded another 10 acres as an experimental plot. So the point here is that we've reduced the amount of money that it would have taken, approximately $6 to $8 million, to do the planting and the fencing of these two plots, one of only 20 acres, and the other of 10 acres. We've reduced this amount of money. Our budget right now is about $750,000, and we're going to be completing this, both the fencing, the planting, the monitoring, and everything, down from a projected cost of $6 million. So you can see how we, by using community activism and volunteerism, we can really reduce the cost of this, and I think for your future studies, that could be considered in. That'll tremendously change the cost analysis benefits of these marsh restoration projects. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Dan. That was a very good testimony of the way things can work together here collectively to really promote not only the resiliency, but also as we learned before, that there could be a possibility that these wetlands could reduce or at least attenuate some of the wave energies within that estuary, affecting the infrastructure along the coast. So with that, maybe we're running out of time here. We have one more verbal question that we can take, and then we will adjourn for today's discussion. So with that, Melanie, would you please move forward with the last verbal question, please?
That was the last one in the queue at this time.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other questions that anyone would like to pose to the group at this time? I just noticed that there was one more. Melanie, would you be able to ask one more verbal question, please?
Yep. Sarah Murdoch has just raised her hand. Sarah, please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks. I have one more other quick question. I guess Kelly again. Kelly, when you were talking about the different services, I think you had 21 services listed, and then you highlighted five of those. Could you talk about a little bit more about what it meant to be highlighted? I mean, you said it was related to the mission of the Corps. I mean, certainly some of those others are important to groups like ours. So I'm wondering what it meant in the methodology or overall in how you use the tool that you're describing to have those particular services, which were property value, erosion protection, storm surge, kind of related to those issues. Those were the ones that were highlighted.
Right. So, yes, this is Kelly. And the reason they were highlighted was purely because if we were to take on a traditional Corps of Engineers flood risk management study or flood risk reduction study, in all likelihood, we would focus on those particular services, and we would characterize or compare and contrast plans based on a return of benefits relating to those services. And now with nature-based and with this kind of broader perspective of ecosystem goods and services, we can look at a wider swath of return. And so that's the only reason they were highlighted, is to basically show that they're still in the list, but there's other services that can be acquired or produced and maybe factor into decision-making above and beyond what we traditionally would have done at the Corps. And being aware also, and I'm going to point it out one more time, that the Corps isn't going to solve this alone, that there are cost share sponsors or stakeholders and collaborators might do things without the Corps even. And so we wanted to point out that there's other things out there that they could actually use or factor into their decision.
Okay, thank you, Kelly. Thank you, Sarah, for the question. We're just about out of time, so if I could just take a moment and thank everyone here today for participating and taking time out of your day to express your interest in the North Atlantic Coast Comprehensive Study, you know, specifically related to natural and nature-based infrastructure and you know, the ecosystem goods and services that that those natural areas and that potential infrastructure could provide to the various communities. Again, this is part of our webinar series that we're you know, running as part of this comprehensive study over the next, I guess, year and a half now, well, maybe next 6 months, once dialogue. But basically, again, as we alluded to previously, the scale at which and the speed at which we're moving, it's not conducive to meeting everyone and having dialogue with everyone that has interest in what is taking place here. So we're, again, looking to these webinars to focus on a few of the more important aspects of the comprehensive study, you know, things that people are interested in learning, you know, that we're trying to tackle here as part of the study. And we appreciate your interest and being able to continue the dialogue as we move forward and put something together for that's useful for everyone going forward. So with that, thank you very much to Amy, Elizabeth, Kelly, and Lisa for presenting today and fielding some of our questions. We also want to thank you very much, Melanie, for addressing all of our technical challenges and getting all the moderators up to speed. So again, and thank you all for participating on the line and you know, sharing in the enthusiasm going forward. With that, we are going to conclude today's webinar. Thank you all for signing off.